Forward Guidance is brought to you by Van Eck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about Van Eck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very happy to welcome back to Forward Guidance, Alfonso Pecatiello of the Macro Compass. Alf, how's it going? What's going on?
Hey, Jack. All good. Very nice to be back.
What are you paying attention to these days in markets, Alf?
Debt service ratio is probably the key metric I'm looking at to grasp whether the pass-through of Fed hikes or central bank hikes around the world is actually impacting the private sector negatively. And I think there is a new theory that goes around that Fed hikes are stimulative, which is an interesting one. It has certain merits to the point that if you hike interest rates, your standard pass-through mechanism to the economy to weaken it would be that the private sector has to face higher interest rate costs. So households have higher mortgage rates, higher refinancing rates, so on and so forth. And as they refinance and debt servicing costs are higher, the share of earnings, the share of salary, the share of disposable income they can spend on consumption goes down because a certain larger share of that pie has to be allocated to debt servicing costs. But if you don't need to refinance anything, which has been pretty much the case in the US for the last 18 months, or very little of that, then of course that impact on the liability side of your balance sheet is pretty contained. But the impact on your asset side can be great. I mean, you can buy T-bills at 5%, right? I mean, there is the treasury of Google or Apple or Microsoft, for example, they're sitting on hundreds of billions of cash. They get paid on that, right? So you have, in the meantime, a positive effect and on the asset side and on the liability side, not so much a negative one. Now, this is a temporary effect, obviously, because at some point, the refinancing cycle kicks in. It does, or to be more precise, it impacts a larger proportion of the private sector over time so that impact becomes visible. The negative impact becomes more visible. And the debt service ratio is a metric that calculates pretty much that. It looks at how much of the disposable income in the private sector gets used to pay debt servicing costs for houses and corporates. And if you look at that ratio, I think it does pretty well to give you an idea of the live pass-through of central banks' hiking cycle. And the US is not really the place where this has been picking up the most lately, but there are many other jurisdictions around the world where that is a visible negative impact. Namely, Sweden, where today the Riksbank, for example, has cut interest rates. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
I think people have gone way too far saying that high interest rates are stimulative. It's like, okay, yes, everyone was wrong that there would be a recession and that 5.5% interest rates would, you know, would take the economy. Yes, people has a fixed rate loan, a 30-year mortgage. Apple, all these big corporations took out huge amounts of fixed rate, very low coupon, low rate debt in 2020 and 2021. This was a known factor. And fiscal stimulus, you know, the government was running a very large deficit. So we have not had a recession. But to say that interest rates themselves are stimulative, to me, is going too far. Yes, Bill Gates, all wealthy people who have lots of cash and in money market funds are making more money. And Apple, Google, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett just said, we have a lot of money in cash. We're making that money in cash. That is stimulative. But on the other side of the fact, you have people who are borrowers who by definition have less money and they spend a much higher percentage of their income. So I just don't buy it. What do you think, Alf?
No, I think it's a very far-fetched theory. I was just trying to explain a new kid in town, which is that high interest rates are stimulative, which obviously is not the case. But of course, if you want to be very cynic and you want to talk about that precise 6 to 12 months part in the cycle where you don't have to borrow, you don't have to refinance, you just don't. But then on the asset side, you get paid a little bit more than before. You can make the case, the very far-fetched case, that on a limited amount of time, higher interest rates can be stimulative. Is that a thing you want to push through or test a new hypothesis that will last forever? Of course, it's bullshit. Can I say bullshit on Forward Guidance?
Yeah, sure.
I hope so. So what I'm saying is we are now at the part of the cycle where I think people have become so frustrated for so long with this slowdown that never happens, basically, that a bit like in 2007, you start having funny theories going around. Okay, back then, it was that the US housing market could continue on forever. I mean, there are many movies out there where they do a very good job at showcasing the idea that if you went there and tried to propose the mere idea of shorting the US housing market, you were ridiculed, right? And there are many, many movies that plot that very nicely. And I think right now we are in the situation where if I have to hear somebody saying that there is something different and higher interest rates are forever stimulative for the US economy, it's a pretty fun theory to extrapolate over time. It's not true. Now, I think that that service ratios will disprove this theory. Namely, if you raise interest rates across the world and you keep them high for a long enough period of time, at some point, the refinancing cycle will hit a large part of the private sector or large enough to impact the debt service ratio at an aggregate basis. And that is happening as we speak in places like Australia or Canada or New Zealand or Sweden. And guess what? GDP growth in these places has been pretty abysmal already. And that is a sign, I think, that the private sector is under pressure. And also central banks are taking notice. I mean, the Riksbank has already cut interest rates today. They are not waiting for the Fed simply because I think they cannot wait for the Fed. And the pass-through of higher interest rates in these economies to the private sector is much more aggressive.
When I've been in Europe, I've noticed that the advertisements for mortgage, the posters, they are variable, a lot of variable interest rates. So the fixed rate, you know, if people listening to this who are American, the fixed rate 30-year phenomenon, it's not really a market phenomenon. It is not natural, you know. It is enabled by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the GSEs that basically allow that to happen. So in most parts of the world, mortgages are not 30-year fixed rate. They are variable. And as such, interest rate hikes from the ECB or the Swedish Central Bank have a impact that is felt immediately or somewhat soon instead of in 30 years.
That is correct, Jack. And there are three ways that the private sector can be structured in a way that you feel the interest rate hikes sooner. One is the one you're mentioning. So you're getting floating rate mortgages or floating rate corporate borrowing. Okay, so in Europe, we have quite a lot of floating rate corporate borrowing. Why? Because the capital markets in the US account for a lot of US corporate borrowing. So it's mostly bonds on capital market issuance, while in Europe, a lot of that is still banking loan related. And these banking loans tend to be very often Euribor plus spread. So namely, they're on a floating basis. You get lent at the benchmark rate Euribor plus a credit spread to account for your credit risk. Now, what is the issue as a borrower if Euribor rates go up? So namely, if the central bank rate goes up, which naturally also brings Euribor rates up, you have to pay more to continue servicing that bank loan that you have received. In the US, that's not the case. As you made the example for Apple, they locked in 20-year rates at like 2% or whatever they did back then. So you have this floating rate corporate borrowing. That's one thing, right? That can accelerate the pass-through of hikes. Then you have floating rate mortgages. And in places like Sweden, that's standard. Floating rate mortgages are the market standard, not fixed. They're mostly floating. In places like Finland, which has the euro, it's a European country, same story. Most of the mortgages are on a floating basis. Then you have the third impact, and the third impact is mortgages resets. So in certain countries, you have a fixed rate market that accounts for most of the mortgage market, but these mortgages are very short dated. They have a refix of interest rates every 5 years. For example, the UK is a market where the fixed rate is dominant in the mortgage market, but you refinance or you refix, sorry, your interest rate every 5 years. So that means the time by which you need to fix your interest rate again, back from the 2% maybe you locked when interest rates were zero, to 6%, which you have to lock now that the Bank of England has raised rates aggressively, is coming pretty soon. So then you need to budget for that is coming. And then the fourth one is the actual refinancing of the notional of the loan or of the mortgage. So that means, are we having a market that has corporate borrowing on a 5 year or a 7 year basis? Or are corporates generally borrowing for 10 year plus? Are people setting their entire mortgage to last for 10 years, for 5 years, or for 30 years? So in the US, as you say, 30 years is pretty much the market standard, I think, but that's not the case everywhere in the world. In some places, people prefer to have a mortgage that has a 10-year expiry or a 20-year expiry, or it can be even shorter on the corporate side. These four factors, they all account for the pass-through of hikes through the private sector. Of course, the fifth one is how leveraged is your private sector. That's also important. How much debt is impacted by higher interest rates or refinancing or resets or whatever. And there is an interesting statistics because I think people are looking a lot at the wrong debt when they want to look for macro fragilities. They're looking at government debt. But I mean, the US issues the global reserve currency of the world, and we know that, issues in its own currency, and we know that. And the macro risks that are coming from that are, I would say, they can still be there in the form of people demanding a higher term premium because they think that inflation and growth volatility are going to be massive because fiscal deficits are not under control. But that type of macro risk is more rare. It's not something that happens once every few years. It's something that happens when something is going really wrong. For example, the UK budget crisis of 2022 is a good example of that. But that's the UK, not the US. There is a difference there. The macro risk coming from debt often comes from private debt. And if you look at all the macro events coming from high leverage in the past, they're all related to private debt, mostly related to private debt or to government debt not denominated in your own currency. That can also be the case, right? But private debt is the culprit of most of the macro risks out there. The Asian tigers, Japan in the 1990s, the Spanish housing crisis in 2012-13, China right now, even if you want to put them in a box, most of them come from high levels of private sector debt. And the US has a private sector debt to GDP of about 150%, and it has not gone up since the great financial crisis. So it's actually running at lower levels than it was in 2007 today.
Yes, the huge levering up in America since the great financial crisis has been on the government has been borrowing a lot of money. The private sector is as levered or maybe even slightly less levered, as you said. And then, yeah, most financial crises are the private sector being over-levered and encountering a crisis because the private sector can't print its own money. The government can, with the exception of that you said governments that can't print their own money, such as all European countries or all countries that are in the euro, such as Greece, right? They can't print the euro. The European Central Bank prints the euro, and the European Central Bank doesn't report to Athens in the same way that the Fed reports to Washington.
And on top of it, if you wanted to use fiscal deficits in Europe in a flexible way, you can't. You can't because there is a bunch of bureaucrats that tell you that you can't run a deficit as a percentage of GDP above a certain threshold. And if you do, they want you to make, what do they call that? Structural adjustments. So namely, they want you to cut your primary spending. The new rules are even more restricted than the ones that have basically killed growth in Europe between 2012 and 2019. So the old rules, the old Maastricht rules used to be based on deficit spending, and deficit spending also accounted for interest rates, payments on that. And right now they're going for primary spending. So if you're running a deficit of above 3%, for example, they want you to cut your primary deficit spending. So they literally want you to get more resources from the private sector. They want you to tax more people, okay? And what happens is very funny there because I once did this experiment. If you overlay deficit spending in the US and deficit spending in Europe over the last 20 years, you can plot pretty much all the growth differential that the US has been able to generate on top of Europe. Almost all of it can be plotted as the result of more aggressive deficit spending in the United States than it's allowed in Europe. And that's an interesting proposition because what I'm saying is the US is more productive than Europe. The US has better demographics than Europe. So that helps on the margin, adding more structural growth to US than Europe. But most of the differential in GDP growth that has been generated over the last 10 to 20 years also has to do with the fact that the US can and is producing a much larger deficit spending than Europe is. So basically, European bureaucrats are tapping the wings of growth in Europe. Not that Europe could grow a lot anyway, but they're making sure it can't by effectively denying any proper constructive deficit spending in Europe.
Alf, inherent in what you just said, I think is a central idea that I happen to agree with, which is that when the fiscal authority, the government, runs a deficit, i.e. it spends more money than it takes in taxes, that government deficit is the surplus of the private sector because there's more money for the private sector to have. So basically, government deficits are stimulative and government surpluses are contractionary. Now, sometimes, obviously, if you have an inflationary boom, it would be appropriate to run a government surplus. But in Greece, in 2012, when according to Barry Eichengreen, so I mean, I'm going to say it's true, that the Greek economy, basically from 2009 onwards, was actually worse than during the Great Depression, the Greek economy during the Great Depression of the 1930s. That, you know, only running a 3% government deficit is highly inappropriate. You should be running a much larger government deficit. If you're having a worse Great Depression, obviously you should be spending way more money. So you and I agree on that. However, I think a lot of people in the macro world, particularly some older investors, so I would say the thing that we agree on, Alf, would be called a Keynesian idea. The older school of the neoclassical school, and legendary macro investor on CNBC the other day, Stan Druckenmiller, said that he was worried about if the U.S. is running so large of a government deficit that it begins to crowd out private investment.
And my new fear now is that spending and the resulting interest rates on the debt that's been created are going to crowd out some of the innovation that otherwise would have taken place.
Basically, if governments borrow so much, all of the money is going towards the government, there's not enough money for Apple. There's not enough money for private sector. In theory, it makes sense. What do you think? Do you agree with Stan or no?
I'm going to quote my mentor, who used to say, do you want to be right or do you want to make money? And Stan Druckenmiller doesn't need to be right on how monetary accounting works. He doesn't need to be right. That's not how he makes money. He's a great investor. Amazing. I love him. But he hasn't done accounting for a long time, I think, because it is a fact. It's not deniable that fiscal deficits equal private sector surplus. It's just an accounting identity. It's an accounting truth. It's not deniable. The story by which if the government spends more than Apple has less resources just doesn't make any sense from the accounting perspective. Now, does that mean, because now we're going into MMT type of thing, does that mean that the government can spend whatever they want, whenever they want, forever? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that if the government spends more, then you will have more money. That's an accounting identity, full stop. Now, what are the limitations to that? Well, there are a few, actually. So the government can't do whatever they want, even if they issue in their own currency. Yeah. So what is the limitation? Well, pretty simple. The limitation would be that if you do too much and too concentrated, so Stan Druckenmiller, I think, is right on the potential risks of that. If you do too much fiscal deficit clustered in a macro period where nominal growth is already strong, Jack, so you don't need the pro-cyclical fiscal spending on top. If you do too much, then you can run an overheated economy. You can run an overheated economy when bond investors are going to ask themselves the question, do I need a premium to buy 30-year bonds? Which is exactly what they ask in the UK. The UK was running at services inflation of 8% annualized at the end of 2022. And Liz Truss said, well, I'm coming in with a new expansionary budget. I'm going to do more tax cuts. I'm going to do more fiscal deficit. So what did the investor do? Well, they sold the pound and they added the big fat term premium on the 30-year UK bonds.
By selling them,
yes. So in order to buy UK assets, they wanted a premium. They wanted a weaker currency, so a premium on the FX front, or they wanted a premium in bond markets. Now imagine if you do this pro-cyclical fiscal spending on an already overheated economy and then you generate this market reaction, well, what happens? Okay, the next time you show up at issuance, you have to pay a premium. And so you're adding even more on your deficit levels because your interest rate spending goes up, and then it can become a vicious circle. So I think Stan Druckenmiller is right on the potential risks that can happen, but I don't know if the US is in the position of being vulnerable to a big term premium bond vigilantes type of action. We for sure have never seen anything like that, because I would invite people to understand that if the long end of bond market is selling off, if bond and long bond yields are going up alone, that is not a reason to say that investors are adding term premium or investors are behaving like bond vigilantes. You also need to have a weak dollar. You also need to have a reaction where people are selling dollar assets, they're selling the dollar, and they're also adding a premium on 30-year bonds. That combination is exactly the type of bond vigilantes protest from the bond market and the FX community, from investors in general, that they're looking at the situation that they're not happy with. And in the US, you haven't seen that. In October last year, you've seen long bond yields go up a lot, right? But you have also seen a big dollar rally coming with it. So far, we haven't seen that yet.
Great point. And also, term premium has widened from being negative 90 basis points to now being 12 basis points. But in the 90s, it was 250 basis points. So we got a long way to go.
I mean, Jack, let's define for a second term premium. It's a big word and nobody ever says what it is. It's unobservable. First of all, it's a bit like our friend R star, which is great, but it's unobservable. And it's a concept that generally mean that bond investors are demanding a higher term premium if they believe that the uncertainty and the volatility around future growth and inflation will be higher. The higher that uncertainty about the growth and inflation cycle, the more I want to be paid, the more term premium I want, the higher yields I want. Why? Well, try buy a 30-year bond, which normally has a duration of, I think today is like 15 or 16 years, given the high coupons. Try to buy a 16-year duration bond or a 30-year maturity bond and try to hold that position through cycles where fiscal authorities are behaving in an irresponsible way. What will happen is that you will have more booms and more busts, right? So you will have a lot of volatility in the price because it's a long duration bond. And because of that vol, you want to be rewarded ex ante with a higher term premium, right? And as you said, in the 90s, in the 80s, this was 200 basis points. So people were demanding a serious term premium. And today what we have done is gone from extremely negative levels to zero. Extremely negative levels means you're willing to pay term premium, negative term premium, for the luxury to own long bonds. So that's where we came from, okay? And now we're back to zero. There is no sign that a term premium trade is going on. And if you're interested in one, also have a look at the dollar. The coincidence of dollar weakness and term premium going up, that's very scary. But we haven't seen that happening at all.
In 2017, Forward Guidance's exclusive sponsor, VanEck, was the first ETF issuer to file for a Bitcoin-linked ETF. 7 years later, Bitcoin ETFs are finally available. Using the VanEck Bitcoin Trust ticker HODL, you can invest in Bitcoin with zero fees until March 31st, 2025. That's right, zero fees until March 31st, 2025. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today or visit vaneck.com/HODLFG to learn more. Now, the disclosures. An investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL, involves significant risk and may not be suitable for all investors. You could lose your entire investment. The Trust offers fewer investor protections as it is not registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940 or as a commodity pool under the Commodity Exchange Act. For a complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. You can learn more about HODL and its zero fees until March 31st, 2025 at vaneck.com/HODLFG. That's vaneck.com/HODLFG. And now back to the interview.
So I just want to go back to a point you made, really important, that making money and being right are not the same thing. And that often people who are right don't know how to make money in the markets. And people who can be wrong but still make money in the markets, that's a sign that they're a really good trader. I would say Michael Platt, who, you know, he's only 55 years old, but he's already closed his hedge fund to private investors. Incredible track record over the past 2 decades. He, you know, if you look up clips on YouTube of him talking about 2012, 2013, the euro crisis, he actually, like a lot of pundits on TV, was dead wrong. He thought that basically the euro area crisis would be, you know, a Great Depression, and that it was basically a huge risk-off episode. Not that European stocks did not do well; they drastically underperformed U.S. stocks, as you know. But you know, he was wrong. He was wrong about that, and yet he still made money. He was on cash and, you know, on CNBC in 2012 talking about how he's only long cash, and yet he managed to make 50% or, you know, that year. So that's very impressive.
It's very impressive, and I think it's the trait of the best macro investors out there, because people have this funny thing that they want to take somebody on Twitter tweeting something. They want to derive his positions, and then 3 months later, they want to go and check how he has done. You have no idea if he has sized appropriately, if he was running a hedge, what he has done in the meantime, if he was running a separate position in the book that had a separate macro thesis that worked out. I mean, one thing is commentary. And here I think you are doing a great job inviting a host of people to share their frameworks. It's all about frameworks. What is that you're looking at? I made my example on that service ratio before. That is part of my framework. Is it right? Is it wrong? Is it valuable? Up to the listener to figure out. But the most important thing is macro, is to develop your own framework, hone it in, work it out. And then once you have that framework, well, I think you're doing better than the average investor who doesn't. But from there to say you have the right framework and you will make money, oh, there is there is a big way to go. I mean, making money is a lot about position sizing, portfolio construction, risk management, being humble, being able to rotate your views on a dime. It's a lot about that. And also with the wrong framework, you can make money. For example, Sam Druckenmiller thinks that deficit spending crowds out the private sector, which is accounting-wise not correct, yet is one of the best macro investors out there.
Alfred, two things. I want to be clear. What Stan actually said on the interview was the crowding out thesis that running large fiscal deficits would crowd out the private sector, crowd out investments, so the private sector wouldn't be able to get enough money. So I think he might agree, or maybe he not, doesn't, but he didn't make a comment on whether a government deficit was a private sector surplus. That, in an accounting sense, is true. But I would say that the support for the notion that money, basically private sector investment, is not crowded out by public sector borrowing is not theoretical based on T accounting, treasury accounting. It is empirical.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It does theoretically make sense that there's a private, you know, there's a huge bucket of money that has a C on it, C for capital. And that money either goes to borrowers or to people who need money, the government or the private sector, G or P. If G is taking up so much money, where's the money for the P, the private sector? Empirically, I would say, you know, during our, you know, my adult lifetime, that theory has just not worked out. But theoretically, it does make some sense, right? At least when I put it in such childish, easy to understand terms.
Yeah. I understand where it comes from. He didn't deny the accounting truism. Let's say he went on another empirical angle, but it's just an example that there have been other investors that maybe didn't have the perfect understanding of monetary mechanics. Not saying I do, I'm just presenting my own framework here again. But as you said correctly, making money and having the right framework are completely different things.
Earlier in our conversation, you referenced four factors. We're talking about interest rate sensitivity. Can you just review what those four are quickly?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I would say the first is the level of debt. Make it simple, right? If your economy is highly leveraged on the private side, please, I'm talking about private sector debt, specifically the BIS data set, which is public. So everybody can go there and download it and play with it. The BIS series, which is non-financial corporations and households. So we're looking at corporates in the private sector, basically, and households, okay? And then you look at the private debt levels. So levels of private debt, important. Second, the share of floating rate corporate borrowing, which is generally linked to how much bank loans versus capital market borrowing is skewed in that economy, okay? So in Europe, it's a lot of bank loans. That means more floating rate corporate borrowing, generally speaking. In the US, it's all capital markets. So that means a lot of fixed rate borrowing for corporates. Third would be floating versus fixed on the mortgage side. Okay, so that's a very common and famous one. Fourth will be the reset nature of your mortgage market. So like in the UK, they reset every 5 years on average. And fifth, the maturity of your borrowing. So is your mortgage a 10-year or 30 years, your corporate loan a 5-year, a 10-year or 7 years? If you take these five into account, I have done it with a what I call a country vulnerability framework, where I score countries looking at these five series. Then you can basically score countries, rank them by how vulnerable they are to an interest rate hiking cycle. So the ones that have the highest debt, the shortest resets, the more floating rate borrowing, and so on and so and so forth, they will be the most vulnerable, obviously. And the countries with the lowest amount of private sector debt and fixed rate mortgages, fixed rate loans, and so on and so forth, they will be the least vulnerable. On I think I ranked about 20 countries in my model. The US ranked, I think, third or fourth least vulnerable. And we discussed why, right? I mean, private sector debt haven't gone up as a level. So private sector debt levels haven't gone up. A lot of fixed corporate borrowing, a lot of fixed mortgages, a lot of long-dated corporate borrowing and mortgages as well, right? And not in a market without a reset. So that's all positives basically out there.
Right. And so in the UK, interest rates reset every 5 years. So theoretically, 20% of every home borrower would have to pay the new rate every single year. Whereas in the US, if a 30, everyone has a 30-year mortgage, that would only be 3% of people would have to, would be forced to pay. Obviously, a lot of people refinance for a variety of other reasons. So yeah, the US is much less interest rate sensitive. So Alf, what is your outlook on the US economy now, where we've had, you know, interest rates have been at over 5% for a long time now?
So I'm going to say something, which is that what's most important is not my absolute outlook, but my outlook versus consensus, which is also the other way you make money in macro. It's not by being right or wrong, but by being sufficiently away from consensus and then having consensus move your way. Basically, at some point, you don't need to be right necessarily, terminally right. So then I would say I look at consensus first, and consensus says that the US nominal GDP growth this year is going to be 5%. Core inflation is forecasted about 2.5 and real GDP at about 2.4. So make it 5, Jack, okay? 5% nominal growth by the end of this year would mean, if realized, that the US nominal GDP would be above 5% for over 2.5 years, which is the longest period of 5% plus nominal growth since 2006, 2007. And then the second one, you have to go back to 1996, 1998. So very hot macro periods for growth in the US, and both of them actually terminated in a recession, the 2001 and the 2008 ones. So this is where we stand. But I think that the 5% nominal growth forecast by the end of this year is perhaps a bit too optimistic at this point. Namely, the debt service ratio in the US has gone up to 15%, 1.5. That's long-term average. We've seen an increase over the last few quarters. It makes sense because slowly but surely, even if the US is one of the most shielded economies out there, slowly but surely, higher interest rates impact a larger proportion of the private sector. It just takes a little bit longer, but it does, okay? So you have this negative impact, which slowly but surely feeds in, versus one of the most optimistic analyst consensus for nominal GDP growth out there. And so that dichotomy, I think, Jack, makes for a good risk reward in fading the strong analyst consensus for nominal GDP growth. So I think you're going to have a disappointment there that comes as a mix of inflation going back down maybe to 2% a bit more rapidly, but most importantly comes from a bit of a disappointment from real GDP growth. Now, finally, let's say that I am right and nominal GDP growth in the US ends up being at 4% by the end of the year. So I don't know, like GDP is going to be 1.8 at the end of the year and inflation is going to be 2. Just naming some numbers, okay?
Real GDP 1.8, inflation 2. And then when you add inflation to real GDP, you get nominal GDP.
Correct. And then you get nominal GDP at like 3.84. So you disappoint market consensus, economist consensus. What happens to asset classes? Because that's the most important thing, right? So that's a fun one because people would say nominal GDP growth disappoints, sell stocks. And I would say nominal GDP growth disappoints, Powell has come up with basically a new Fed put, and I can elaborate on that if you want, buy stocks. That would be the first reaction. And it's funny because if you look at periods in which nominal growth in the US has disappointed consensus, but it has done so without being recessionary. So that means you get an acceptable level of GDP growth, an acceptable level of inflation. And the Federal Reserve had a dovish reaction function. Actually, these were the best periods for stocks, not the worst, despite growth disappointing. That's because the Fed dovish reaction function trumps anything else when it comes to the short-term performance of stocks, because the change in valuations, the change in forward PE that comes from having all the uncertainty removed by the Fed, having a Fed put, having Powell coming in and say, oh, whoa, 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 the labor market is only adding 150,000 jobs a month. Oh, I see cracks emerging. I need to come in and proactively cut interest rates. That effect is much more positive in the first instance for stocks than it is the slowdown in nominal growth. So on the stock side, the first innings, a bit what we're seeing today, I would say, of Powell removing the hiking uncertainty, cutting that tail away from the distribution and focusing on when are we going to cut rates, really helps stock markets do okay, even if nominal growth disappoints slightly expectations. And on bonds, well, that would be definitely a steepener, a bull steepener of the curve that we have been basically not seeing for a couple of years. People have been waiting for it, calling for it, talking about the best investors in the world. You have had Bill Gross, big guys going on TV, calling for this big steepening coming, and it doesn't come. We're just inverted all the time in two stands. It never disinverts. I think if you finally see a deterioration of nominal growth, a little bit of a deterioration, and you have the Fed happy to come in and cut more than forwards are pricing, then finally you can have the steepening of the curve, because they're not cutting on anything that is terrible for growth. So as they cut interest rates in the short term, the long end of the bond market will interpret this as a support for long-term inflation and growth. And so the cuts come in and they lower your front-end yields, but long-end yields can be a bit supported by this proactive dovish stance, and so the curve bull steepens. So long stocks, if that comes true, being long risk assets and bull steepener, I think a bit like 2019, to give you a reference, would be pretty much the macro asset class scenario at play.
So long-term bonds rally, it's just that short-term bonds rally by a lot more.
Yeah, in that case, that's the case, correct.
And that's because nominal GDP falls, but just not to recessionary level, and that's bullish stocks. Is that your base case?
I would say that my base case for the next 3 to 6 months is pretty much that one. So what I've been doing here, for example, is nothing extremely fancy. On April 22nd, I bought some call spreads on the S&P 500. So that's a structure that allows you to be long the S&P 500, but identifying a certain payoff. So you buy a call and you sell a nearby call. You get paid if the S&P 500 gets to that level of strikes, but you're selling your upside. If the S&P goes to new highs, goes up 20%, you don't get the full benefit of it. And the strikes are 518, 520 in SPY, where we basically are today. So what I did is, during the drawdown, I looked at my macro models and said, well, there is not much has changed here. I think the Fed put is still alive. Nominal growth should slightly disappoint consensus. And therefore, you want to fade any drawdown in that environment, because the Federal Reserve is there to close the distribution for you, to cut away these hikes from the distribution, to cut the uncertainty. There is a Fed put out, basically. That's what it is, in my opinion. And therefore, you want to try and fade that and get long the stock market without being excessively bullish. I think there are ranges and valuations coming in at some point where you need to be a bit more attentive. And these call spreads expire next week. They're close to basically being nicely in the money. After that, for a further rally in the stock market, it requires you to hit new highs every week and every month after that, right? That is a scenario that could still unravel, but the conviction levels in chasing new highs in the S&P 500 is there. I will take it month after month. But the highest conviction at that point will be doing carry strategies. So those are strategies that effectively make money if macro volatility is low. If you don't have a lot of surprises coming up, then you get paid effectively to pocketing premium. And those strategies are a few out there. A few are very popular and known, others not really. For example, FX carry. Okay, that's very known. So you buy a currency that is high yielding, you sell one that is low yielding. VIX roll down. Okay, that's an interesting one. The VIX curve has always a particular shape where if you're able to sell long-dated VIX contracts that are normally offering a premium or a volatility premium, you roll down the VIX curve. So over time, if there is no volatility spike, you basically get paid to roll down this VIX curve. Okay, that's one other strategy. You can sell straddles in the S&P 500. Same story. There is a certain level of volatility out there priced in. You sell that away, and as long as nothing blows up, you get paid. All of these are versions of selling volatility, basically getting paid to pocket in volatility. And they work until they don't, but there are macro scenarios in which, as long as the central bank is cutting away uncertainty, as long as macro volatility is low, even if you get a disappointment in nominal growth, as long as the volatility in that macro surprise is low, you actually get paid for that. Not a fascinating period, but something that is unraveling under our very eyes. The S&P 500 realized vol has been 10% or around 10% for a bit.
Yeah, borrowing in Japanese yen to buy U.S. higher yielding currencies, it's a great trade, number one, just because the yen has been depreciating. When you talk about that, but when you talk about selling equity volatility, again, it's relative to market expectations. So you say volatility has been realizing 10, but I'm looking at the VIX now, implied volatility, kind of, and it's 13. That's pretty low. So like, obviously you'd want to sell it in late March 2020 when the VIX was at 60, after you just had the biggest financial crisis ever, the biggest, you know, in the stock market, because everyone was still pricing for a dramatic crisis. And, you know, what occurred was a huge rally where volatility compressed,
Likewise, if you were to talk to me in late April 2022, okay, the Fed just did its first hike. Volatility is at 33, and the VIX is at 33. If it realizes 25, you're still making money. But at 13, if it realizes 15, the VIX is probably going to go to 19 and you're going to probably lose money. So isn't VIX too low to be selling volatility?
Absolutely. So I'm not implementing these ideas through selling equity vol. That's pretty low. Or let me correct. The premium you get against spot vol or a credible range for realized volatility is not very high. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. But for example, if you buy the dollar and you sell a currency like the Swiss franc, just making an example, okay, you also get paid quite a lot of carry to sit on that trade. You have the Swiss National Bank that is very much on the dovish side. They want a weaker Swiss franc, not a stronger Swiss franc. They have inflation at 1% in Switzerland as we speak, 1%. So they're going back to this idea that they need to weaken the Swiss franc, which is, by the way, what they try to do for the last 10 years. Barring the small episode of 2022, they did the same for the last 10 years. So you have interest rate differentials your way. You have central banks, especially the Swiss National Bank, that is pushing for your trade, right? They want the weaker Swiss franc. And you have positive carry at the same time. So that can be a trade that pays you if nothing is going on. And it's a bit akin to say, well, I think US macro volatility is not going to be very high for another 3 months or 6 months. So I can safely be long the US dollar versus some low yielding currencies. You can do the same thinking on Mexico or Brazilian real if you think that they can still provide you with that buffer of carry or let's say carry adjusted for volatility. Alternatively, again, if you are into the 2019 camp, 2019, namely, nominal growth in the US slows down, but not to scary levels. And there is a live Fed put, which was basically the case in 2019. If you look at asset market returns, what happened back there is pretty simple. Stocks made money and bonds made money. And in particular, the curve bull steepened. Gold also made money, but it has also done a great run here to date. So you're looking at a market that basically has a risk parity sort of rally where all assets do well, basically. And also there, the dollar doesn't depreciate because other central banks are more dovish than the Fed is. So then it becomes hard for the dollar to sustainably depreciate, especially against low-yielding currencies like the Swiss franc. And that's, I think, my base case. But when it comes to, this is the macro base case, this is the talking head base case, where I can go on CNBC or on Bloomberg tomorrow and tell them that this is my overview. How do you implement this is different, because your point on the VIX is very true. I wouldn't want to sell equity vol at 13. That doesn't make much sense from a risk management perspective. So right now, the live trade I have on is this call spread that expires next week. And from there, I'm looking at steepeners in the yield curve that might make sense. But again, talking head is easy because a steepener is a negative carry trade. That means if Druckenmiller or Bill Gross go and say, I like steepeners, I also like steepeners. But if you want to run steepeners in your trading book, you are paying negative carry and roll every day, every month. And I can explain why.
It is. Wouldn't you be like selling a 10-year to be long a 2-year? And isn't a 2-year carry more?
So you will be buying a 2-year. So let's say you do two stands, okay? If you want to do two stands steepener, what you need to do is you need to do them duration adjusted. Okay, so that means you will be buying, please don't quote me on this, I don't have a Bloomberg in front of me, you will be buying roughly 2.5x, roughly maybe 3, I don't know by the top of my head, but about, let's say three. Let's assume three. Three times the 2-year future, and you will be selling one time the 10-year future. So forget about the future, let's talk about bonds for a second, okay? So now what you're doing there is you're receiving three times more in terms of the size, basically, of your 2-year contract. You're receiving or you're buying these bonds, okay? If you're buying futures, that means your alternative to that will be to simply depositing money at repo or at Fed funds, okay? That's your starting point. And these repo rates are built into future prices. So think of this as, this is my opportunity cost, this exists. Now, 2-year rates are pricing in, how many cuts is that? I don't know, 100 basis points, 200 basis points, okay? Something like that.
So that's negative carry because, yeah, when futures cash, you're borrowing money at the spot rate, which is 5.3% to buy something that's 2 years at 4.8%, and that's negative carry.
To make it duration adjusted, yeah. You're doing that three times as much as you're doing that in the 10 years, right? So that makes the trade basically every day, if nothing happens and the curve isn't steepening, that makes the trade slowly lose money. So again, it's easy to say I like steepeners, or it's easy to say I think a recession is coming, but playing that from a risk management perspective requires you to size trade appropriately, use stop losses, have a risk framework, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think a recession is coming?
Talking head answer or risk manager answer? Talking head answer is the odds are higher than they were 12 months ago. Sure, because the refinancing cycle, as I explained, gets more lively. We are far away from the starting point. I mean, the starting point of a recession is the US adding less jobs than the labor supply brings in every month. Okay, that's a labor market recession. Basically, you're having more supply of labor than demand of labor. And if that gets bad, Jack, then you have a recession. Right now, before the big immigration flow in the US, the labor supply, consistent with unemployment rate being stable, demanded the US to add about 100,000 jobs a month. If the US added 100,000 jobs a month, it could absorb the new labor supply coming in the US every month. And so roughly unemployment rate would be stable. Today, that number is a bit higher. You can say maybe 130, 120, 130K. So the US needs to add about 120 to 130,000 jobs a month to keep unemployment rate roughly stable, looking at the labor supply. Now, we are running over 200,000 right now, and we have been running over 200,000 on a rolling basis for a while. So the starting point is reasonably far, not very, very far, but reasonably far. The direction of travel, I think, is south for nominal growth. Do we ever cross the recession Rubicon? Maybe, not sure. What does it prevent it? If inflation comes down fast back again, like it resumes the Q2, Q3, Q4 disinflation pace of last year, then the Federal Reserve has a very nice window to start cutting interest rates early, which means the refinancing cycle becomes way less punitive, right, for people, because the Fed is bringing in this forward rate, is cutting rates. So when you actually go to refinance, it's much less painful. And that window, I think, is still there. The soft lending window is still relatively open, but the odds of a recession right now should be put a bit higher than they were 12 months ago. Again, does it matter what I think about it? No, it matters what I think about what the market is pricing. That's the most important thing, because what the money you will be making in macro comes from deviation from consensus or from pricing. And if I look at the market implied distribution for Fed funds over the next 12 months, which you can derive from options underlying the SOFR contracts, a number of cuts over the next 12 months in line with the US recession, which historically have been 250 basis points roughly in the first 12 months, let's say. So the Fed cutting 200 to 250 basis points in 12 months from now, that probability is below 10% according to option pricing. What do we make of 10%? Well, the US used to have a recession once every 7, 8, 9, 10 years. So 10% is market pretty much pricing the historical one-off probability of the US going in a recession next year. Okay, roughly once every 10 years. What are the preconditions for next year? Well, the Fed has hiked to 5.25%. It's keeping rates higher for longer. We have a refinancing cycle that is coming in. So I would argue, without knowing anything else, that you would need to price the US recession next year a bit higher. If I were the market, on a market neutral basis, I would price it at maybe 15, 16, 17%. It's priced at below 10. So some of these convex recessionary hedging strategies are relatively cheap right now.
So you're bullish the 2-year?
I think that there are better carry adjusted ways to express that, but roughly this is the same way of saying I like bull steepening. It's the same thing. You would expect, right, Jack, that if the labor market deteriorates a bit faster, then the curve steepens because a lot of cuts are getting priced in the front end. Being long 2 years is a bit punitive from the carry perspective. You can express it in other ways. But yes, my inclination is to expect a stronger nominal growth slowdown, which surprises both economists and market consensus right now. So you can get paid by doing trades similar to being long 2-year rates. Yes.
So on an absolute basis, not taking into account what the market assigned probabilities, which will, you know, that is how you trade, but just your own probability, do you think what is more likely, a soft landing, a no landing, or a recession? Could you rank those three in terms of which you think is most likely to least likely? And then we'll talk about what the market's pricing and how you trade on based on that.
next 12 months, I would assume that the highest probability scenario is a soft landing with the current set of information. I would probably price that somewhere around 60 to 65%, so strong base case. No landing, I don't know exactly what it means. Let's assume long-term. I never understood it, but let's assume that...
You know what it means, Alf. You know what it means. It means high nominal growth, high inflation, bonds continue to do...
Oh, really high inflation as well. Okay, so yeah. it means something is different permanently in the US. So you're running these high levels of inflation and nominal growth permanently. I would say the probability isn't very high, but maybe let's put it at 10 to 15%, like a relevant tail, something along these lines. So then we are at 75 to 80%. Yeah, and the remaining 20-ish roughly would be the odds of a recession. So 20% from a historical perspective is actually not so low. As I said, the US in any given year has the odds of a recession at about 10%, once every 10 years, roughly over the last 50 years. And I'm putting my own subjective probability at about 20. And the market is at about 8, as we discussed before.
So that would be bullish fixed income assets, which rally as the Federal Reserve cuts rates.
Yes, particularly the front end. If that discrepancy comes into reality and you can monetize it somehow, then you're right. Particularly the front end will be rallying a bit more aggressively and the curve will be bull steepening as a result. The first innings, funnily enough, will be of a nominal growth slowdown because we are over 5 now. So the nominal growth slows down from 5.5 to 5 and then 4.5. As long as there is a Fed put out there, stocks will actually like that. That's the funny part, as we are seeing today, right? So you have a risk parity rally, basically, in the first innings that involves everything, gold, bonds, stocks, everything. And then later on, it can morph into something a bit more risk off. So a bit more of a mix market reaction.
So you're broadly bullish all assets now?
I would say that, yes, if you look at the next 3 to 6 months, it's hard to be particularly negative. You have to expect one of the two tails to realize right now. Macro tails, because the Federal Reserve, from a monetary policy perspective, has cut all possible tails. So the most negative tail for bonds and stocks is hikes from the Federal Reserve. Okay, that's the most negative tail. And Powell did everything he could at the press conference to avoid any questions about hikes. He doesn't want to talk about it. Forget about it. So, okay, if you need to cut that tail away from a monetary policy perspective, very hard to get a negative push for stocks or bonds, okay? But it can come from macro. Macro data can actually deliver that tail, right, Jack? So if you want the negative stock and bond reaction, then you need to have strong inflation. Because Powell was also clear, if you get strong growth, he doesn't care. He's not going to hike because there is strong growth. He's going to be very happy about strong real growth. If inflation keeps surprising on the upside, yeah, that will be the negative tail. Now, my view is that given market consensus and economist pricing at 2.5% inflation by the end of the year and core PCE is at 3 as we speak, I think the hurdle for a hot inflation surprise over the next 3 to 6 months is pretty high. And given that I don't think the macro tail, the negative tail will realize, and Powell has cut the monetary surprise tail, it becomes very hard to be negative on risk assets in general.
Sorry, you said that the odds of a negative inflation surprise or a positive inflation surprise is high. Which one?
The odds of a hawkish inflation surprise is very low, I think, over the next 3 to 6 months. We already had one, by the way, in the first quarter of this year. Any inflation number, be it core PCE, core CPI, super core, wage growth, you want to name it, all of them, we had all the surprises we could have, hawkish surprises on the inflation front.
Inflation being higher than expected, you mean?
Yes, higher than expected, wage growth higher than expected, all of these. And if you go check the market reaction, by the way, you'd be pretty surprised. Of course, bonds have sold off a bit from early this year to now, and that makes sense, right? You've had a sell-off in 5-year, 10-year, 30-year bonds, which is consistent with some hawkish inflationary surprises. But if you look at risk assets, even that has not been really able to derail the bullish risk asset trend out there, mostly because Powell has not reacted to these hawkish surprises, Jack. He doesn't want to talk about hiking interest rates. He's cutting away any uncertainty from the distribution of outcomes.
Right, but I feel like this... 7 cuts were priced in at the beginning of the year, and to go from 7 cuts being priced into to hikes being, you have to get the cuts priced out.
Yeah, that's true. So we had We had the distribution, which to be precise, had as a model outcome in January, three cuts, only three, but it had a very fat left tail. So the recession scare was still priced in pretty aggressively. Now we've priced that all out completely. So the distribution now doesn't have a recession tail. It has a slight hikes tail, slightly bigger than the recession tail, but not really. And now the model case is 1 to 2 cuts in 1 year. That's it. And now the distribution is well centered around this outcome. 1 to 2 cuts, tails, both the recession and the higher for longer, very thin. That's where we are today. Now, with this set of information, if you want to be negative on stocks, for example, coming from a hawkish monetary policy surprise, what you need is to get that hawkish tail fatter, correct? You need to have that hiking tail become fatter. That will be the next surprise that actually brings down stocks. And Powell has been pretty clear, if you ask me, that he doesn't even want to talk about that side of the distribution. And who am I to challenge Powell? Or as my friend Jim Leitner would say, who am I to challenge the game master?
Alf, what else you got cooking up at the Macro Compass?
At the Macro Compass, the good old usual, doing research for clients. What is new, actually, is that I am launching my own macro hedge fund. So this is something I'm proud of and humbled about, because I run money until 2021 for ING Germany. And then I stopped doing that to go my own, basically to have the advisory shop I have today with hedge funds and family offices and so on and so forth. But it's time again to be back into the game, Jack, because I think the set of macro opportunities out there is massive and will be there for the next 5 to 10 years. So I left the bank on a very boring macro environment, which was prevailing between 2014 and 2021 pretty much all the time. And now I come back opening my own macro hedge fund with so much macro vol and opportunities out there, which honestly is very exciting.
What is the source of the macro volatility that was absent from 2014 to 2021?
Well, I think it's, first of all, that fiscal is not a taboo anymore. I mean, in Europe, it was a complete taboo, and now it still is, but there are some, maybe even discussions there going on. In the US, it was never a taboo, but it was used anti-cyclically. So if the economy was weakening, politicians were going for fiscal deficits and vice versa. And right now it seems to be like a permanent setup, right? It's a permanent feature that the US has large fiscal deficits. And I think that accelerates macro volatility. And then you're having idiosyncratic situations going on. You're having China doing a certain thing with their own macro story. You'll have a bunch of economies out there that are not equipped the same way the US is to handle higher interest rates. And that's another set of macro opportunities. I mean, I think there is a lot going on.
And are you going to be specializing in currencies, carry trades, and fixed income stocks? Are you going to just do everything? Like, oh, if I want to be long uranium, I'll be long that. Or is there any restriction on, or just, no, it's the Alf show?
No, we don't do single stocks. That's the only thing. Okay. We do macro, global macro, which means we trade mostly in futures. That's the best and most flexible and liquid expression of most of the global macro ideas out there. So those are futures in interest rates, in equities, in commodities. We'll do a lot of FX products as well. Also ETFs, when the expression is best done through ETFs, for example, equity sectors often don't have a liquid futures underlying. It's best to do them through ETFs. But mostly I would say it's a global set of opportunities that we are pursuing. So it's not geographically limited. And on an asset class perspective, it trades the four most liquid asset classes in the world. So rates, equities, commodities, and FX.
And just to give people a sense of what, not your biases, but your views now. So you talked about US stocks, European stocks, Japanese stocks, Chinese stocks, you know, in a minute or less.
All possible. And it's a fund that runs a 10% ex ante vol. So that's the target of the fund, tries to run it around 10% volatility. And it's a fund that, that tries to achieve returns that are uncorrelated to standard betas, equities, bond beta. So the returns are coming not from standard beta exposures, but rather from market neutral macro opportunities. So you can think of relative value ideas between two countries or two currencies that are not directional to the dollar. All these ideas that come from idiosyncratic set of opportunities that are going on around the world, plus obviously trying to catch the occasional macro trend that develops ahead of times, right? That can be maybe a bullish trend in equities or a bullish trend or a bearish trend in bonds and so on and so forth.
Alf, are you feeling like you got to launch a hedge fund just because you conquered Twitter? You know, there's no one, you're Alexander the Great of Twitter. There's no one else, you know, you become number one.
So you've got No, that's not it. I mean, I don't even know what number one in Twitter will be in this case, because Twitter is an interesting place where I think the 2022 Twitter experience we had was very interesting. Everybody was at home. Everybody was trying to do research to figure out what the hell is going on in this big monetary experiment we are running. There was a lot of sharing and information. I remember, for example, fondly when Efficient Market Hype, which is, I think, a hedge fund PM in Singapore, I think, just going out top of my head, he wrote a book which I would recommend anyone to go and look at. It's fantastic. It's called something like The Guide to Bondistan. I don't know. It has an amazing name. It is beautiful. It's the best source of information on bond markets that you can ever find, ever. It's incredible. There are Bloomberg screenshots. And even if you're not a Bloomberg user, there is a lot of information on how to do a structured trade on futures, a curve trade. All of that was going on Twitter. And honestly, if I look at what's going on today, it's perhaps a bit less exciting. But that's not the reason why I'm opening the hedge fund. I'm opening the hedge fund because I think there are a lot of opportunities out there. I'm doing that because clients from the research side and the previous network have asked me to do that. I'm humbled and really, really happy to be back into the game.
Yeah, I think at Twitter, there used to be so much free information that maybe shouldn't have been free, which is a great value. I think a lot of that has moved to Substack, where I believe you're still on Substack, right?
Yes, I have a free newsletter that goes out on Substack every 10 days or so.
Got it. But none of your paid stuff is on Substack. It's all on...
No, it's on my own website, yeah.
But a lot of people have moved to Substack, to paid Substack. And it's like, yeah, if you're posting about, you know, preferred shares on, you know, banks, like it's that... That maybe people should pay for that. So that's the way it goes. Alf, people could find you on MacroAlf. Where else can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think, the usual media channels, that's the easiest one, Twitter and LinkedIn and whatever. And if anyone is ever interested in having a chat about the fund, they want to know what it is, how it works, whatever, they can just send me an email. The email address is fund@themacrocompass.com. Pretty simple. Just send me an email. Whatever inquiry, question, you want to have a coffee, a chat, just send me an email. I'll reply personally.
Is the name of the fund going to be the Macro Compass?
No, but I can't reveal yet what the name will be.
Can't reveal the name. All right, well, I look forward on seeing your progress with the fund, and great to catch up as always, Alf.
Thanks, Jack. Talk soon.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vanek.com/hodlfg to learn more about the Vanek Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL.